Okay, so nobody needs copies of the chart of the movements of faith and resignation. If you do, there they are. Now, two things. Several people have asked me about the podcast. You know as much as I do. They don't send me any messages. Don't be surprised they're not there yet. They're staggering them, and each week they bring another amount, a bunch of them online. Presumably they're there. They're recording them. And when they do finally bring them online, they'll give you the retroactive for the last 3 weeks. But I can't tell you for sure when that's going to happen. I think beginning next week. At least that was what it said once in an announcement from them long ago. Now, and I've been asked to put my office hours on the board. I never told you my office hours. Is that right? Do any of you know my office hours? Only a few. No wonder I see so few of you in office hours. Okay. I'll put them on the board right now. Okay, and when you have questions, come in. And if there are already people in there talking about Philosophy 7, just come and join the group. It turns into a kind of the discussion group, and that's fine. Sometimes it's people in there discussing Heidegger instead. Then you come in anyway, and I'll tell you when I'm going to get finished with the Heidegger people and turn to 7. Any questions about any of that? Well, then we're ready. Well, I hope you like the film. I'm sure it's very strange to you. It's a very strange movie. And it's very, very hard to understand the first time through. I think maybe it was more like 5 times through before I even began to get a sense of what was going on. But you're all more video trained than I was. When this movie came out in 59, I think it was. And I think you catch on faster. But we'll see as we discuss it. And another thing I want to tell you is I put the DVD and the VHS version on reserve in Howison Library, which is, I don't know the number, but it's right next to my office. So if you find 303 Moses, you're standing in the doorway of the library. That is on the 3rd floor of Moses. And you can take out the DVD or the tape for overnight and watch it. Also, I got on reserve the paper, the book, the scenario of Hiroshima Mon Amour, because if you end up writing papers on that, you'll certainly need to either buy or go to the library, the philosophy library, and read the scenario to find quotes to back up whatever you're saying. And on the subject of papers, they're due the end of the month, as you know. We plan by next weekend, I hope, to get by a week from tomorrow the sample paper topics on the web. And you don't need to write on them, but they'll give you an idea of what kind of paper would make sense to write. And then you can, if you have a topic of your own, so much the better. But you need to clear it with your TA to make sure that it's not a topic that we worry about might lead you nowhere. Any questions about that? That's just bookkeeping background. Oh, and one more very important thing for what we're going to read, where we are in the assignment. I'm going to talk about problems 1 and 2 now. And that's what you should read for next week in Fear and Trembling. Let's put it over here. Problems 1 and 2, they go together. They're both about the relation of Abraham to the ethical. he's clearly doing something unethical when he's going to go out and kill his son. And now I have to tell you just one thing you need to know in order to read it, which hasn't seemed to have confused anybody of the writers who write about it or anything I've ever read about fear and trembling. But there's one important switch, which if you're reading it at all carefully, it would drive you crazy. That in the preamble from the heart, Isaac is Abraham's defining commitment. It's through Isaac that he becomes the father, will become the father of the people, and that's who he thinks he is. But when you do problem one and two, you switch, and Isaac becomes the ethical. And killing Isaac means going against the ethical. In problem one, anything could happen to Isaac. It wouldn't have to be Abraham's fault. It's about how what happens when the relation becomes impossible, and when you can't carry out what it is that was going to define you. But in the preamble from the heart, in problem one and two, it becomes strictly a question of when you kill Isaac, you break the moral law. What about that, Abraham? Just bear that in mind. Now, we're ready to go to Hiroshima Monomoor, which is, and for the rest of the time, and it'll take all the time, it's a complicated movie. So, from the very beginning, and literally the very beginning, the first line, it's already incomprehensible in a way that you won't really understand, you're not supposed to understand, until way later in the movie. But it begins, besides the pictures of the bodies, which is supposed to just get you into the sense of a, she says, there's lots of comments in the scenario by Marguerite Duras, what she's trying to do, and she says about this, the main thing is that we get the feeling that this dew, it's like dew on the bodies, this perspiration has been deposited by the atomic mushroom, and it should produce a violent, conflicting feeling of freshness and desire. I don't know whether it did in you. I didn't see much freshness, but it doesn't make any difference for what happens next. What happens next is, though the bodies are there moving around, these voices of the man and the woman, who are obviously not speaking right then, because it would be a pretty weird way of making love to be carrying on this sort of detached philosophical conversation at the same time. But it's sort of what they're thinking or what they stand for. Well, I don't quite know what it is. But what he says is, first sentence, you saw nothing in Hiroshima. Nothing. And she says, in a voice that's flat and monotonous, like she was reciting something, if that's what the directions say, I saw everything, everything. And then they repeat it that's very mysterious. We'll talk about it more in a minute. They repeat it with variations. She says, I'll give you page numbers in the scenario so that if you decide to look these things up, you'll know where they are. She says, I know everything. And he says, nothing. You know nothing. And finally, and most important of all, they get into the same kind of discussion about memory and forgetting. She says, like you, this is 22 bottom, like you, I know what it is to forget. And he says, no, you don't know what it is to forget. She says, like you, I have a memory. I know what it is to forget. And he says, no, you don't have a memory. Well, that's all pretty amazing. And the first thing to ask is, well, what do you normally think? You hear that, and you make sense of it. What sense did you make of it? At this point, there's a certain way you ought to understand it. When she says you saw nothing in Hiroshima, and she says I saw everything, or you understood nothing, and she says I understood everything. How do you hear that? Somebody tell me just to make sure you're with it. There's a perfectly sensible way to understand what they must be disagreeing about. Yeah? No? Cool. Come on, somebody must. Yeah.
Well, she wasn't actually there, so she can't have actually.
That's right. Perfect. Yeah, surely all of you thought that. Otherwise, I get worried. You think, gee, well, of course, she thinks she's seen it. She's been to the museum, and she's read about it, and she's thought about it. She thinks she understands it altogether. And he's saying, no, you don't. I've been through the total destruction of my world. We find out later that his family, and that could have meant his mother and father and brothers and sisters, but also his wife and children, everything was destroyed except him, because he wasn't in Hiroshima, he says. He was out in the army. Anyway, so he certainly must have experienced a lot, you would think, that she didn't understand, and that she shouldn't even be claiming to understand. And that's what you think first. And that's how it sounds when they discuss it on page 18. She says, I've always wept over the fate of Hiroshima. Always. And he says, no, what would you have cried about? I mean, after all, she didn't live there. Her family wasn't killed there. That's what he's saying, and that sounds right. And he's, I mean, just to give you the pages, he's lost everything there. It was a world-destroying disaster for him. Whatever gave him his identity and whatever gave him a sense of what was important, whatever is wiped out. You hear that on 29. She says, were you at Hiroshima? No, of course I wasn't. Then she says, oh, yeah, how stupid of me. He says, but my family was at Hiroshima. I was off fighting the war. She, a stroke of luck, eh? And then the interesting thing, he looks at her, long time, weighing the pros and cons, and says, yes. I mean, why wasn't he just saying, yeah, sure, it was terrific. Well, when your world is destroyed, it's not a big, and maybe you'd rather be dead too. And so it isn't obvious at all. But that just reinforces that he had suffered such a total disaster that he wasn't even sure whether it was better to be alive or dead after that. And it sounds right, as he just said, and I hope you agree. The French woman can't understand all that. She hasn't had her whole family wiped out and so forth. And yet, and now it begins to be interesting, what could she mean when she says that she understood it, she remembered it, what's the first sentence you saw? She's seen it. She says, I saw everything. I mean, what could she mean? Yeah.
By the end of the film, it seems like she's relating it to her own experiences, although, you know, she did not literally have a Hiroshima-type experience.
Exactly. She also has had a total world-destroying experience. She lost her defining person. And that's crucial. It's interesting that how many have actually bought the Hiroshima Monomoi? It was in the bookstore. Well, then I have to definitely tell you that there's a completely wacky mistranslation on page 13, which is the introduction. The synopsis, but I don't know who wrote it, but in French, it makes perfectly good sense. But in English, the synopsis ends with the following. It's trying to explain what Nevers, the town she's from in Hiroshima, mean to them. And it says, they are names of places, names that are not names, whatever that is, fancy talk. It is as though through them, all of Hiroshima was in love with all of Nevers. I have no idea what that means. And there's no hint of that in the French. The French says something else, just what he said. The French says, the disaster of the woman head shaved in Nevers and the disaster of Hiroshima correspond exactly. Now, how you could call that a translation? It's more like a hallucination. I mean, there's no correspondence between. But that's the right thing to say. That's the whole point. The whole movie operates on the assumption that they correspond exactly, down to minute details, like the fact that when they were suffering disaster and world destruction, everybody in the world elsewhere was singing happily. In her case, it was the end of the war, the liberation of France by the Americans, and everybody else was singing the Marseillaise, and she was mourning her just recently killed lover, And for him, when he experienced this, same kind of experience, then everybody was celebrating the end of the war with the Japanese, the surrender, because we dropped two bombs. But he was in misery. So, I mean, every detail corresponds. And another way it corresponds, you remember, it goes by so fast. At one point she says she was filled with bitterness. And he says, you spit in your mother's face. And she says, yes, you would know, or something like that. They were both filled with bitterness because of the awfulness that happened and that everybody else was happy. Okay, now that's just the background. But everything else is going to make sense on the basis once you sort that out. So now comes the place where it begins to look like she must have read Kierkegaard. And I have heard that she had read Kierkegaard. I wish I could find, somebody saying that. It would just be nice to know. In fact, I think I'd rather that she hadn't read Kierkegaard, because then it would show that this phenomena, that this complicated phenomena of knights of faith and knights of resignation and all that, is something that anybody can get if they're just a deep person who's had enough experience. I don't know. But it looks like she's got the distinction between lower immediacy, mediation, and higher immediacy. So we start with that. What happens first, we find out about nature. Early, right about in the beginning of the movie, on page 19. Hiroshima was blanketed with flowers, cornflowers, gladiola, and they came forth from the ashes with extraordinary vigor, unheard of for flowers till then. And the same thing with the fish in the river. They came back with extraordinary amount of fish of all colors and shapes. I forget where it is, but it doesn't. Well, let me just, if I find it, I'll tell you. 24, I think. 24. The branches of the river Oto freshened and rich with fish, gray and blue, depending on the hour and so forth. In other words, what about nature? Does nature care about world-destroying disasters? Not a bit. I'm a little puzzled why nature comes back even stronger than before. I had an idea about it about 3 days ago, and I thought, aha, but then I forgot it. So I, luckily, it's not central, but I hope I remember it again. But, I mean, does not seem to me that when the caterpillar, maybe it's like the caterpillar becoming a butterfly, though that wasn't my thought last time. I mean, nature can take a turn for the better by sudden changes. It doesn't matter whether nature stays the same, but the main thing is that nature comes back. It's the immediate. And I say, look at Fear and Trembling, page 72. I don't remember why, so let's look and see why. I think I've read this already, about two-thirds down. Only lower natures forget themselves and become something new. Thus the butterfly has already forgotten that it was a caterpillar. Perhaps it will so completely forget it that there was a butterfly that it will become a fish. I wonder if that's a sign that she's read it, because when she thinks about the lower nature, she writes about fish. But in any case, so there's the bottom level, the immediate, nature, that vegetation. And then, the woman too is in nature, and has a part of her anyway, her body, it goes on. And in spite of the world-destroying disaster, remember some things. Her hair grows back. We hear on 98. She gets over her madness in the spring. On 37, she says, just in sort of passing, mumbling, that her madness went away little by little. And then, of course, when I had children. All that is nature. But she doesn't want to be part of nature. She doesn't want to be a lower nature. She's resisting that. On page 23, we hear that, in the middle, for my part, I struggled with all my might every day against the horror of no longer understanding at all the reason for remembering. And so she's holding on to the memory of this world destroying disaster. She's not going to just forget it and go off with somebody else. Now, you wonder, but she's off with him. But I'll tell you more about that later. And she has plenty of lovers, it turns out. But that's different. That's not like the German. And she's not going to forget the German. And She wants it to be a lasting thing in her life. She wants it to be eternity. She talks about, she wants a memory of stone, it says on 23. Where is that? He says, no, you don't have a memory. Well, that's part of the, you don't know what it is. You don't know what it is to forget. Like, she says, like you, I have a memory. I know what it is to forget. No, you don't have a memory. This is going to turn out to be very important later, but I can't tell you what it means yet. But she says, like you, I tried with all my might not to forget. I wanted to have an inconsolable memory, a memory of shadows and stone. And then you see the bicycle sort of photographed onto the stone by the bomb flash. She wants, and it seems she wants eternity and to get out of time. That's really, I guess, what's going on in her madness. Since it's madness, it's a little hard to tell. And it isn't something we have to figure out. But she's in the cellar, and she talks about on 59 that she wants eternity. She says in a trance-like state, it says. And then on 62, more about that, he says to her, and then one day, my love, you come out of eternity. That is, she can't live, since she's a human being with a human body in the human temporal world, she can't really stay in this timeless mode, which is just sort of craziness, catatonic craziness. So she comes out of it. By the way, that same page says, and I didn't read it, but I'll read it now, this is the bitterness. She says, oh, what pain. It's unbelievable. Everywhere in the city, they're singing the Marseillaise. And that's, but I'll go back to this. So somehow she wants to be in eternity and not be gobbled up, so to speak, by nature and become lower immediacy. She figures out, in effect, without thinking about it, her sensibility teaches her a way to have eternity and time without being crazy. And there has to be something about her which is not going to change like nature. Now, what is that? What has she discovered? What has she discovered when she can come out, that allows her to come back into the world and in time still have this kind of timeless eternity? What has she got that keeps her from being like nature and changing and outgrowing and forgetting? Yeah. That's right, but it's a certain way of having it, because she's very worried that she'll forget the memory of the old German lover. What has she done to keep that from happening? Yeah. Well, one of you, either of you, go ahead, or both of you. What? Well, she has the commitment already. I mean, he's her defining commitment. That's sure. She's totally in love with him, as she says right before he slaps her, he was my first love. Not having anybody, any other lover.
No, not having him.
I can't. Somebody tell me what she said. Wait, I'll come over where I can hear both of you. That's all right. I just can't hear you over there.
She means not telling anybody else.
Ah, good. I got it. Yes, that's right. But that's sort of, it's true and it's important. She hasn't even told her husband, as you were sort of knowing. But that follows from this other deep thing she did. You going to say something? She wants to say something.
Well, she told her lover.
Yes, but that's very special. That's so special. But we'll get, and it had this huge dramatic effect on her and on him and the whole plot when she finally told him the story when he got her drunk in the bar. But what movement has she made to talk like Kierkegaard? Which means in some fancy talk, what way of behaving has she taken up? What?
She's taking an active resignation.
She's got infinite resignation. She's turned her love into the eternal, invulnerable significance of the love, which she constantly remembers and idealizes and holds on to as the most important thing in her life. That's not even the right way to put it. The defining thing in her life, That's what a night of resignation does. And that gives her just what Kierkegaard says nights of resignation have, comfort in sorrow, as he puts it, I think, on 74. That sums it up so well that I certainly want to see it, so I'm looking for it. Well, it isn't there, so let me think about that. Why isn't it there? 74. Do you see comfort and sorrow around in there? There must be some reason I said I should look at this page. It's a variation on it. About 8 lines from the bottom. In infinite resignation, there is peace and repose and consolation in the pain. I mean, obviously, there's 2 kinds of pain. I mean, remembering this terribly painful loss is pain. But then, of course, she's remembering also the joy of riding her bicycle to meet him in the countryside and so forth. But the real sorrow is that you have to give up the finite and the temporal joy of living with somebody intimately, day in and day out. That's that's the sorrow. We've talked about that already in Kierkegaard. That is, if you want to make your love safe, and by making the movement of resignation and saying what really matters is that the meaning of this love is what defines me, you give up being able to live day by day happily with the loved one. You don't even know what to do with them. She doesn't have that problem since he's dead. There's no problem about what to do with him. But there, she has lost something. The comfort and sorrow is what she's got. And it's so wonderful in the movie. They've done it so well. There are pictures in the scenario. And you see her looking this mixture. You can see it on, there are many pictures, but I'll try to tell you which one I really think is perfect. The ones around page 30 and 31, particularly the top of 31, where she's looking, that's the moment she sees, first with a sort of happy look, the Japanese man lying on the bed, and then she sees his hand, and then she sees his hand moving, and it cuts to the German lover dying. And this mixture of sorrow and serenity, too, at the same time, is very peculiar. And it's perfect for what he's trying to say, what it ought to be a night of resignation. She should be serene and sad and definitely, you know, frozen in time. I wonder what that is. I learned it. Let's see. I guess that's the same. Yeah, that's just those pages. So she's got infinite sadness because she's lost the world and lost the temporal day by day with the other person that she loves. But it's infinite sadness because it isn't just that some events are sad. It isn't even that all events are sad. Remember, whenever you see infinite in Kierkegaard, it means that the world is such that any new event that came along would be sad. It's not just the total of anything of what's happened already, because it's a world-defining sadness. She lives in a world that is sad. Anything that comes along is going to be sad. That means she's infinitely sad in Kierkegaard talk. All possible events and situations are sad. And what she wanted, she says, is when she lost her lover, is to be dead too. And in a certain way, she is, because she's outside. I mean, if living is living sort of alive with somebody intimately, body to body and going through the world together, she's lost that on purpose. And she says on 65, all I could find between his body and mine were obvious similarities. Do you understand? And then she shouts, he was my first love. And at that point, she's gotten so deep into her resignation and her self-pity and her hanging on to this defining experience. That's when he slaps her to try to knock her out of it. And he does knock her out of it, sort of. She comes to, and then she starts telling the story again. One day I screamed and they put me in the cellar and so forth and so forth. And we got to go more into that now. But so she's given up the finite and the temporal. I have pages to tell me that too. 78. She says, Huh. When she said, I didn't think about this. Let's see. They talk about they have 3 days. She, time enough for what? To live from it? To die from it? Time enough to know which, she says. That doesn't exist. Neither time enough to live from it, nor time enough to die from it. And so I don't give a damn. I take it that means, and I would have preferred that you had died in Nevers. And she says, so would I. But I didn't die in Nevers. I mean, so that's just perfect to explain. She doesn't care about anything that happens in time. She wishes she were dead. She does the best she can to be dead in a way that it doesn't mean that she doesn't make movies and enjoy spending the night with the Japanese man, and she's very happy the next morning and out on the veranda drinking coffee and looking serene. But it means that that nothing important can happen in time for her. Everything important has been eternalized, namely her relation to the German, and that's all that's important. That's the meaning of her life. And that gives her a certain interesting ease and detachment, which you don't have in the movie in words. You see it, but Marguerite Duras describes it, and it's really interesting on page 11, no, 10. And this is nice. What happened in Nevers, her native city, what happened to make her the way she is, so free and yet so haunted? See, there are going to be a whole lot of things now. Why is she free? Well, because nothing can hurt her. Nothing matters. Remember, ethics doesn't matter, and what people think about her doesn't matter. Nothing matters. But yet she's haunted, of course, by this secret. So honest and yet so dishonest. That's an interesting one. She is before she even tells him the story, she's very frank with him, expressing exactly what she feels and how her views about things and her enjoyment of the sex they have together and all that. That's, she's completely honest and yet so dishonest. Why? How? Now that should be, you should know. Why is she completely dishonest? Does she tell anybody who she really is and what she really cares about? Nobody, not even her husband, knows. Oh, and took the Japanese man a special thing. How come he knows? The moment she mentions Nevers, he sits up in bed and turns on the light. He knows that something happened in Nevers that makes her special and makes him so attracted to her. And what happened? Well, her German lover died. But she didn't tell him, tell the Japanese man. She didn't tell anybody. And she is so equivocal and so clear. She seems so open and clear. And yet, of course, again, it's always the deepest thing about her you don't know. And then so cowardly, so predisposed to chance love affairs, and that is open, and so cowardly when faced with love. That means commitment. That's what he wants. And the thing to see there is that what she wants is really a commitment to somebody finite and temporal like the German. But she can't have it because she's got her infinite resignation toward the German. So she's open to all these love affairs and even looking for intimacy. And yet she's totally afraid of a commitment because, as it gets clearer and clearer in the movie, why is she so afraid of the commitment? What would it do to her? Can you see that? You see that coming? That's right, the German lover. If she loves the Japanese man, she's going to forget the German lover. And that's the thing she is totally afraid of, because what would that do to her as in levels of kinds of being? What kind of creature would she be then, from her point of view? Lower immediacy. Yeah, that's right. She'd go back to being like the caterpillar. And what she wants more than anything else is to have a meaning, a fixed meaning in her life. We'll come back to that, because that's absolutely crucial. But it starts being crucial at this point. Let's see. I want to do Fear and Trembling on 67. I tell her probably it's the same point. Well, when here, and again, you really wonder when she gives that description, of the lady. And Kierkegaard says, knights of infinite regulation are readily recognized. Their gait is gliding and bold. That's another thing about her. She is so sort of serene, nothing can hurt her, and bold, because again, nothing can hurt her. It could have been in that list from Marguerite Duras. It's the same idea. Now where are we? Uh-huh. And it all comes from being invulnerable. She's lost everything, and in a certain sense, she has nothing to lose, and she's got everything by making the love eternal and defining. And so she's already got everything won, but she's certainly invulnerable. And what does she lose? Well, I've said it. She can have these sexual encounters, but what she can't have is intimacy, because she can't talk about what's really important to her, the only thing that's really important to her. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Something that I wondered is whether she actually had a husband or whether her husband was a German who she had actually pledged an unconditional commitment.
Now, she had no husband, the Japanese, the French woman. No, I don't know what makes you think so. That, oh, she has a husband. Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, she has a husband. I better turn this on. I forgot. I hope that the pod people are taping this anyway. But anyway, she has a husband. She has a husband and a child, but she got no intimacy with her husband. If intimacy means that you tell people and what's important to you and who you really are, and he's got a wife. And remember, they're both happily married people, and meaning that they've got a kind of satisfactory relation. But it's outside of what's really important to each of them. Now, him we don't get to till the end of today, but because it's not, he's no knight of resignation. But he's complicated and interesting too. Let's stick with her for a while. Where are we? Okay. So. She yearns for real intimacy. That's when she talks about how it's great to be with a human being right now. I mean, it never works out, apparently. She says, where does she say that? Too many different books. Two is too many. So she says on 68, oh, how good it is to be with someone sometime. But that's, I mean, it's that sort of interesting thing for her to say, because that's true in any case when she's with one of her lovers, whenever she picks one up, whatever she's making her movies. But it's also something she's saying because with him, it's much, much more really with someone once they have each understood that they share this big secret that their world was destroyed and that they're living out of it, after it, and somehow in terms of it. And so that's what she really wants. She yearns for that kind of intimacy. And he can have it, it looks like. And she sort of half understands and doesn't. I'll talk more about that later, too. I think she really never understands what he's up to, because she knows that he's got something she hasn't got. He's happy and he's totally different from her. He's completely happily involved in the current scene in Hiroshima. He's a politician, it turns out. He's an architect, and so forth. And he's certainly able to sort of throw himself completely into his pursuit of her. All of that, she hasn't got at all. And she talks about this on 77 of the movie. She's saying these strange things. Take me, deform me to your likeness. And that means somehow make me like you. But you've got to see, I mean, these people don't know, you know, these Kierkegaardian terms, but what's happening is, how do I draw it like this? So here's the night of resignation. Here's the night of faith. I have to talk about this because people came into office hours, those people who could find me, and And there was, here's the defining commitment. This is the chart you've got. I'm not adding anything. There's the defining commitment. And then there, wait a minute, is that right? Yeah. And then mediation so that it isn't fanatic and it isn't dependent. And then this sort of branch point, which is the movement of resignation. This is very hard to understand, and Kierkegaard doesn't understand it very well himself and messes it up, so no wonder you can't understand it. I mean, it took me years, and I'm not even sure this is right, and if you think it isn't, write me a paper and I'll change my lecture. But it seems that the movement of resignation is the moment when you realize, Kierkegaard says, that you can be sufficient unto yourself. That you understand your eternal validity. Now, I don't have any idea why he says that. I mean, it just muddies things to say eternal validity there. But it's some jargon that he's got from somewhere, maybe Hegel or something. What the phenomena is that if you're not going to be fanatical, if you're not going to think that if the other person dies, you have to die, then, and like Lear with Cordelia, as I said, and so forth, then you have to understand that you could be self-sufficient. He has to have this, otherwise he gets this business of total dependency on the other person, where you think that you couldn't exist if they went away. And that's not the way to think about it. She exists okay. I mean, she has lost the ultimate crucial meaning in her life, and she would have rather died, but she's getting along. I mean, because she's made not only the movement of resignation. So far, the movement of resignation is that she could get along without her German lover. But she's made a movement further. She became a knight of resignation. The tricky thing is, in Kierkegaard, that everybody's got to make the movement of resignation. But to make a knight of resignation means you install yourself in it. You say, that's the end of the line. That's what I'm going to be. I'm going to just build my life around as the person who loved and lost the German soldier. That's more than just saying I'm self-efficient. That says I've got a defining commitment, and I'm going to sort of take it up into myself, and it does make me self-sufficient. That it makes me self-sufficient in a way, and this is the crucial thing, that I can't get from there to here. Because if you're a knight of resignation, then you can't get to be a knight of faith, and a knight of faith, we're going to come back to that today, is able to be happy in the finite and get the finite and temporal back to see the Kierkegaard thing, the sword over the head of the beloved, and yet find joy in the finite as if it was the surest thing of all. She can't do that. That's why she's stuck up here with comfort in sorrow. But I got to remember why I'm saying this, to tell you something important. Oh, yeah, why she has to be destroyed. This strange line, destroy me and make me in your likeness. I take that to mean, and he takes it to mean, and that's what he tries to do when he gets her drunk, is you've got to sort of destroy the old personality, the narrative, the kind of person she's become as this gliding, secure, resigned, sad person, and bring her back to here, and then she could come up here and be like him. And that's what she sort of dimly realizes when she says, destroy me to your likeness, and destroy me, you're so good for me, and so forth. And he tries. He tries brilliantly to destroy her whole narrative. And the interesting thing is he does, in a certain way, almost destroy her whole story with the German. But it doesn't work out the way he expected. I have to go into that in detail, but not quite yet. But she wants to be like him, and that means, I think, capable of real intimacy, which he certainly is with her, but she can't reciprocate with him. She's afraid of it, but she's not even afraid of it. As long as she's up here, So it would be disaster for her and her understanding of the meaning of her life. Again, for reasons that are hard to see, but I mean, not obscure, but subtle, which I will get to. But the confusion that Kierkegaard has, I don't want to go into it, is he sometimes says you make this movement and then this movement, And then sometimes he says, you make the movement of resignation simultaneously with either this or this. And that's the right thing to say. Because if you really had to make the movement, if this, I don't even want to explain it. It's too crazy. If you make the movement so that you go through being a knight of resignation on the way to being a knight of faith, then this diagram doesn't make any sense. There isn't any way to get from here to here. So it must be that you make the movement of resignation and you go on making it and you get in a way that gets you up here, or you make it and you go on making it in a way that gets you up there, and whichever one it is, it's something you hold on to simultaneously. And that's okay. It's not something to worry about. He should have just said that you do it. He says the knight of resignation makes the movement of resignation and then more and one more movement, and it's marvelous they become a knight of faith. That's wrong. And he says that in the other place he says he's always, even the knight of faith is simultaneously making the movement of resignation. That's right. But as I say, I stop worrying about that. I haven't even got the page references because I'm not interested in when he messes up. Now let's see. So she's, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Could you, any of you got that enough to be able to answer her?
Are you imagining like a dot in the middle with the two circles not being concentric, or are you imagining like three concentric things?
Two, and then overlapping.
Oh, there's an area. Yeah. I see what you're imagining, but I don't see why yet. I mean, I see that you're seeing these two circles, and what is this thing of overlapping? I see the movement of resignation is shared between the two.
Yeah, the whole movement between with the diagram that's on the board in the middle is hard to see, but I'm just wondering if that could be.
Well, that's okay, except that doesn't capture the fact that this one is a dead end and you can't get from this one to this one, which is what I'm trying to capture. It does capture the fact that they have something in common. If this is the night of resignation, I think that's what you're thinking, right? And this is the night of faith, and they have this much in common. They both made the movement of resignation, right? But there's something very special about being a night of resignation, and that is to get sort of hooked in this one in a way that you can't get to this one. And I try to get that with this picture, and I don't think the Venn diagram gets it better than I got it. I think I got it better. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right, because he says that Abraham makes a double movement. And on there, yeah, I could see him going both directions.
No, he shouldn't. That's the wrong way to think about it. Abraham, or good, if you think about it, maybe you're saying the right thing. Abraham makes the double movement. That is, he's up here, and he goes there through here. But he does not become the knight of resignation. The knight of faith just isn't the knight of resignation. And if you are a knight of resignation, you can't be a knight of faith. And the way to put it is, do you get the finite and temporal or don't you? And if you're over here, you are absolutely outside of being able to live with the actual intimate bodily other person, because you turned the meaning, all you care about is the meaning of the relationship, which is safe. And nobody can be in both of these. Either you want to make the meaning safe and you give up time, day by day life with the other person, or you get a funny kind of funny, I mean a mysterious, which I'll explain by the end of the hour, I hope, kind of relation which you can live with the other person in finite time and in the everyday, but with the security that you would have over here. I see why you think you've got both, because he lives as if it's the surest thing of all, and he lives, or she in this case, as if it's the surest thing of all, but they do it absolutely differently. She does it by getting rid of time and thereby making it safe. Nothing can come along that can hurt her. And he does it by faith, which we haven't understood yet. But I have let the cat out of the bag in the sense that maybe you already realized the Japanese man is a knight of faith. It's a lot harder to show a night of faith and a night of resignation, and therefore he looks just like anybody else. But remember when you read the part about the guy who's going home to have the porridge with, and he's a knight of faith, but he looks just like, he could have been a bank teller, I think it is. And this guy, but anyway, I can't get ahead of the story, sorry. Or I will not get it'll get messed up. So let's go back to where I was. Okay, the next stage is the Japanese man comes on the scene. But now we're not going to understand him yet, but we're going to have him understanding her. And they're going to go to this nightclub, and he's going to try to break her down so that she can become start a different kind of life. He's going to try to destroy her resignation. Interesting, a student pointed out to me, this is the kind of thing you will all help me, there's never an end to the interesting details. Do you remember the name of the nightclub? Was it not a nightclub, a tea room then? But it's, what's its name? Casablanca. And what? And why Casablanca? You also, how many have seen the movie? All of you, I imagine. Those are two nights of resignation. They have absolutely decided that each of them will remember forever the love that might have been, but didn't work out. And so it's perfect that they should be doing this thing there where he's going to try to now fix her. But right now, the problem is how to fix a night of resignation. And the answer is, well, get her to tell her story and turn it into a story instead of a secret. And he understands that he's got to get her to talk about what happened in Nevers. And this, I mentioned it, but I'll show you the page. He says at the bottom of 51, he says, tell me about Nevers, and he says, it was there I seem to have understood that you must have begun to be what you are today, which is, of course, right. Everything he understands is always exactly right. And how does Nevers look in the movie? When you see the town, how does it compare to seeing Hiroshima, these two towns, which are going to become the names of the people in there? And so you need to look at the towns. What's it like? Does it look just like a normal town? Well, no, I think he filmed it always in twilight, never any lights on yet, but pretty dim, no cars, no people around. It's dead. It's really completely dead. I mean, and how is Hiroshima? Well, the lights are on all night, the neon signs are flashing, it's full of people running around, and so forth. I mean, it's sort of as if you could, it wouldn't work, but I like to think of it as if Nevers is filmed in black and white, and Hiroshima wants to be in color. I mean, you want to see all those lights flashing, and it's just as full of life as you can get. I mean, at the limit, you would want to use computers and film her in black and white and him in color. You're lucky I'm not making this movie. I would certainly destroy it, but that's the supposed to be, I think, the feeling you get. And now he gets her to tell the story. And I just tell you this to keep the plot straight because it is so confusing. He gets her to identify him with the German soldier. I mean, he understands that that's what's going on and that she's stuck on the German soldier. So he starts her saying, you were, and so forth. And for a while, she's talking to the Japanese man and saying you, but she's really talking to the German. And that's the first time through the movie, sort of confusing. I see if I can turn to it. Where are we? I'm not sure I can. Yeah, when they're at the Casablanca, obviously, but when is that? Ah, here we are. There's a picture of him slapping her in here. So, okay. She's starting to say, she's talking about eternity and how she was young once, and she talks about what pain in my heart and so forth. And all of this, she's talking to him in terms of you. And she's talking about the German. I'm beginning to forget you. I tremble at having forgotten so much love. And then she switches over and into talking about what happened again. And we were supposed to meet at noon on the quay. This is 64. I stayed near his body all day, and she switches back to talking about the German. And then she switches again into this terrible sorrow for herself. He was my first love, and so forth. But the main thing is, and I'll try to explain this now, he's trying to get her to tell the story, and thereby it won't be this super secret that defines her anymore. How does that work? Well, let me get to where I am. He's got this nice idealized memories of the countryside and how, and they're making love in the little house that they found and so forth. And so it looks like maybe she once, here's the slogan you might say is he sees in a therapy kind of way that if he's going to get her out of this, he's got to get this story out of her. And he got to get it out of her into the public domain, so to speak, so it is a story. And then he can get her out of being all trapped in it. And he does get her to tell it as if it was a story. And that completely backfires. Because once she's told her story, she feels that she's been unfaithful to the German. So she says, very important at the bottom of 73, "You were not yet quite dead. I told our story. I was unfaithful to you tonight with the stranger. I told our story. You see, it was, you see, a story that could be told. For 14 years, I hadn't found the taste of impossible love again. Since Nevers. Look how I'm forgetting you. Look how I've forgotten you." And so forth. And that's why. And how has it backfired? Well, because it worked just the way he wanted it to work. But that didn't work. That is, he got her to see that this wasn't some marvelous, totally individuating disaster, but that it was a story that could be told, and thereby it becomes a three-penny novel, the one translation says. I don't think the one, that's what. What does this translation say? Does it say a three-penny novel? Yeah, something like that. It's slightly different. But anyway, it becomes a trivial story, a story that could happen to anybody. It's not her defining thing anymore. What gave it her unique identity was having this terrible secret. And now this comes this twist where it backfires. How is she able to preserve the tremendous significance of this story, which if it were just a story would be, you know, anybody could tell it and you could read it and it wouldn't be what made her whole life important, meaningful and so forth. There's one way she can keep the meaning of the story and keep it from being a mere story. And that is, and it's hard to see, but it's, she, in the end, I can say it in my language, she has to sacrifice her life for it. The only way that she can show that it's really important is that she will give up everything else that could be important to her for it. And then it's no mere story. Then it's something super that gives her life unconditional meaning. And that's how his move fails. By threatening her, in a way, with losing it, he forces her to sacrifice him because she can't have them both and she won't give up the German. And turn that into a story, because then she'd just be a lower nature. And she's only got two alternatives. She's either got to be a lower nature, or she's got to save the eternal significance of the German lover. And when he sort of confronts her with that, she chooses to save, she has to, being a knight of resignation, she chooses to save the significance of the German lover. And that means to sacrifice her possible intimacy and her possible happiness with the Japanese man, and he loses her. But we got to go into more detail. But anyway, go ahead.
So by him making her story in danger, by him doing that, does that make her go into being the knight of fate?
Well, no. No, that's what he hoped. If he could have broken her down, broken down her story, sort of knocked it out of her, literally, and then she could have done this. But what happened was instead she retreated back up here when she saw the danger and saw that the only way to preserve this this relation with the German and not let it be just a general story that anybody could read or anybody could do is to be ready to die for it. And that means to become a martyr for it. That means to make somehow the ultimate sacrifice for it. And the ultimate sacrifice is to give up the finite and the temporal, to give up the Japanese man, to give up the possibility of intimacy. And that's what she discovers she has to do. Otherwise, she's going to be just trivialized. That's how she sees it. And so now we follow that. Let's follow that. Because we quickly, of course, she sees that she's trapped in a kind of despair. She can't, there's no way. She's only got two choices, lower nature and a meaningless life, or a meaningful life as a knight of resignation, holding on to this love as the highest thing in her life for which she'll sacrifice everything else. And she chooses that, but that's painful. That's desperate. That's desperation, because that means she gives up forever the possibility of an intimate love again, like the German. And okay, now that's my way of talking about it. Let me read it to you. On page 83, she sort of states her despair. When she sees all that I've been telling you, she immediately, she sees that if she goes on, it'll become a three-penny story, and she sees that she would become, and this is the middle of 80, silly little girl who dies of love at Nevers, little girl with shaven head, I bequeath you to oblivion, three-penny story, it was, and so forth. It was just the same then as it was with him. It will encompass your voice. This is very important. She sees that if she forgets the German and goes with the Japanese man fully, then she's become lower nature because she'll equally well forget the Japanese man, maybe. I mean, if she betrays the German, then there's no reason to think, given the kind of person she is, that she won't betray the Japanese man. The same will happen to you as happened to him. Little by little, you will become a song. So now she sees that she can't give up the German and have the Japanese man. There's no way for her to give up the German without admitting that she can just drop what looked like a defining commitment, and then she's just back in lower nature. So she says on 83, I'll forget you, I'm forgetting you already, look how I'm forgetting you, look at me. And she gives, quote, a moan of utter sadness, the direction says. That's despair. That's just not any old moan of utter sadness. That's the realization that to have meaning in her life, she's got to give up the joy of the finite and the temporal and keep the comfort in sorrow. And she sees it, and she does it. She's not going to go with him. Okay, now let's see. She sees that a life of infinite resignation, I wrote here, isn't working. It hasn't worked. It never will work. Where working means to be joyful and secure like the Knight of Faith is. We'll get to that now. But we see that she has to choose between this kind of non-temporal eternity and happiness in time. And she sees it and she chooses it. She goes and gives him up. Now, let me see. I want to make sure that I get to the Japanese man. So, okay. Now that we've got to go to the Japanese man right away. Let me see. Okay. And you find out about the Japanese man by looking at Hiroshima, which we did a little already. All action. Now comes the big insight into Hiroshima. Another place where some student hit me over the head maybe 20 years ago and saved me from total stupid interpretation. I mean, I thought that Hiroshima was like the flowers and the fish, that it came back even more full of life and full of light and so forth than it ever was before. And I thought, gee, I had no opinion. I just thought that's what the movie was about. And that turns out to be completely wrong about Hiroshima. I led about 10 years of students astray telling them that Hiroshima was lower immediacy. But why isn't it? You tell me. What should I have seen You almost get hit over the head with it by the way the movie is done. Yeah. Yeah, okay, yes, but right, that's right. The Japanese man is a knight of faith, and he's Hiroshima, that in the last lines of the movie. But I'm trying to understand now what it is to be a knight of faith. What is the Japanese man? And you have to look at the city to find out. First you, and then you. Yeah. Absolutely, that's the important thing. That the camera dwells on the hotel name. Remember it? What's the name of the hotel? The new Hiroshima. They didn't just rename it the Hiroshima or name it the Hilton. They named it the new Hiroshima. And what else? What, were you going to say something like that too?
I was also going to say that they also have parades and celebrations.
That's right. They make peace movies there, as she was in. The museum is there. Everything, they take over the disaster and they incorporate it into a way that they can go on living happily but not forget it. And that's why they're not lower natures. They don't forget it. They do something else with it, which we haven't really fully understood yet. Yeah.
I would like to comment on something I saw in the movie, that you haven't mentioned. When she is facing Alexander, she says, "Don't worry, I'm going to be okay." And she mentions something about the movie nature naturally, and says, "Dear, you
are a shame." We don't joke about the...
Yeah.
That's good. That's right. Add that to the list. I mean, they take this very seriously. By the way, in case I forget to say, it's interesting. His job is to, politics is to, you know, prevent this bad thing from happening again, presumably. And architecture, I mean, rebuild the city. He's all part of the new Hiroshima. And her job is so perfect for her. Well, her job is to constantly reenact the disaster. She's a professional person preserving as vividly as possible the disaster. Okay, so now let me go back to Hiroshima because I'm getting nervous that I won't get you the deep insight about him. It's the new Hiroshima, and that's related to the puzzle, which I'm going to try to now give you at least the first glimpse of. On page 65 in Fear and Trembling, the crucial mysterious lines that you wonder, remember, now you wonder about Abraham. And you think Abraham is a knight of faith. He thinks Isaac won't be sacrificed because he has faith, and God wouldn't do that, you think. And yet, you ask yourself, but what if Isaac were sacrificed, which is the same as what if you lose your lover? What if the lover dies? What happens then? Well, Kierkegaard faces it. He says, about 15 lines from the bottom of 65, "We let Isaac actually be sacrificed. Abraham had faith. His faith was not that he could be happy sometime in the hereafter, but he should find blessed happiness here in this world." See, that's what she gave up. "God would give him a new Isaac, bring the sacrificial offer back to life." What can that mean? Well, Kierkegaard doesn't really know what it means himself. He knows that there's something going on there, but Kierkegaard is writing from the point of view of Johannes de Silentio. And Johannes de Silentio is a knight of resignation. And he doesn't understand the knight of faith, except that there's something wonderful going on that he doesn't understand, just as she doesn't understand the Japanese man, except that there's something strange going on there. And she doesn't understand the city, because what she sees in the city is the museum and the peace parade and so forth. But there are two ways to get a new Isaac. One of them is wrong. Bring the sacrificial offer back to life. I doubt if any of you have seen a movie called Or Dead by the great Danish director Dreyer, have you? Well, it's a story about a guy who reads a lot of Kierkegaard, and then a woman dies who is an important woman. It isn't his love, but it doesn't matter. And she's in the coffin dead, and this guy who's been reading Kierkegaard stands at the bottom of the coffin and thinks hard that all things are possible, and that Isaac could, what do we put it, be brought back to life, and the lady gets up and walks off out of the coffin. That's not it. That's too. It is not going to break the laws of physics and chemistry. Whatever it is, you get a new Isaac. You don't really get the old Isaac back. But you don't betray the old Isaac either. How do you do it? Well, I think we can see what Kierkegaard, all upset about Regina, couldn't see, that there's one movement that he hasn't talked about, and that's grief. And grief is going to do the job that we need to do. What you want is the following. You can't forget the first love or the first Isaac. They've got to stay and be definitive of you. But they're gone. They're sacrificed. They're dead on the story we're considering. So what can you do? You can take them over into you. In the jargon of therapy, internalize them. And then you will be open to relate to somebody else, a new Isaac. But you won't have betrayed the old one, and this is the crucial part, and it's perfect in the movie, because you will not only, you won't remember the first Isaac, the first love, you'll do something deeper than that. If you internalize it, you will relate to everything in terms of having loved and lost this first one. And you see, that's exactly what he's doing. Let's suppose now he had some love and this love died. He's not thinking about her. Just as he's not thinking about all the bad things that happened in Hiroshima, he's not saying, let me show you where our house was and where my love was killed and my family died. And he doesn't even accompany her to the museum. That's not as interesting to him. But he sees her and understands her perfectly through his first disaster. And he also does his politics through his first disaster. In fact, it's in a little detail. He knows French and can talk to her because of politics, which in turn is because of his first disaster. And now I have a way of putting this, which I discovered when I was teaching at MIT, where they don't understand anything if you don't write it in sort of algebraic form. I of course can't remember any algebraic form, but it's on your thing here. It's called the MIT version. You must have wondered at the bottom what in the world that meant. Okay, here's the MIT version. X has a defining commitment for Y. That's fine. Now Y dies. Okay, that the night of resignation, this is now the night of resignation, idealizes Y, puts Y into this otherworldly, perfect bracket where they can remember Y forever, right? Okay, but what else could you do? You could have X sub Y. That means you internalize Y. Y becomes part of you, and then, this is the night of faith, you're open to a new whoever, a new Isaac. In the case of the Japanese man, you're open to the French woman. But the grief is completely paradoxical. And it's got, remember now we've got to talk about paradoxes what's the other word, absurdity and so forth. If you experience grief, you've got the following experience if you do it right. I mean, she also had grief, but she did it wrong. She got stuck in it. What is the way to do it right? Well, you've got to really suffer the fact that you've lost the only person that could ever really define who you are, and you're never going to find anybody like that again. They're not just the smartest, sexiest, prettiest, handsomest person in the world. They're the world-defining person, and they're gone, and so is your world, and everything is gray, as Augustine says, and nothing has any meaning. And now you can make sort of the Augustine move, which is like her move. And no, sorry, no, forget that. Augustine doesn't even get as far as she. You make her move, and you can idealize the relation. We saw that. But in grief, you both feel that you would never be able to have another love like that again, and that you will have another love like that again, that you can't, that somehow everything is going to be all right. That's faith. Faith is, in his Kierkegaard jargon, for God all things are possible. And that means, in Kierkegaard, for God, even the impossible is possible. But that doesn't mean getting out of the coffin like in the Dreyer movie. It means that you can have an experience which is contradictory. You can be in grief, and you really have to suffer the fact that this is over for good and not hang on to it. Let it become part of you, however, which is this. Take it up into your whole life is as important as it ever was, but change it from being an object that you love to being part of you on the basis of which you will love again. You can do that, but it's not a thing you can think. You can't think to yourself, well, good, let's go through this grief because if I do it right, everything's going to turn out all right. That's rational, but it's crazy. It won't work. You've got to really believe this is it. My world is gone. My identity is gone. It's over. And that's terrible. And you've got to never give up your, in Kierkegaard language, faith. And what is your faith? That even though you can't understand this move, you can do it. And you don't think to yourself, oh, well, I'm going to do it now. I'm going to have faith and then I'm going to do it right and everything's going to come out all right. You just do it. You have faith, meaning you go through this grief and you remain open to another love because you can internalize it. That's what it means to say that Abraham had faith and that meant that God would give him a new Isaac. And that's what Hiroshima does. Hiroshima becomes a new city, takes on and keeps the old. Well, everything, let's say, in the extreme that happens in Hiroshima happens in the sort of presence of the ruin that's in still. Isn't there a ruin preserved in the old, in the city of the disaster and so forth? Okay, so that's the way you can keep your defining commitment, keep your identity, and so forth. I got a slogan for this, which is, helps a lot to remember it. She's dwelling on her relation to the German. He's dwelling in his relation to, let's say, whoever. I don't know a Japanese first name for the lady in his life. But and the point is, see, dwelling in it is another way of saying he has internalized it and sees everything in terms of it. And that makes him able to do something that she can't do. Now, I've just got time. And we'll see that. And, of course, that's what's happening in the end. She sees him lost in wonder. I think that's exactly the way the Silentio sees the night of faith. He doesn't understand it, but he knows that it's a wonderful thing to do, but he knows that he can't do it. She sees the same, and then she says to him, Hiroshima, and he says, yes, that's my name, and she never fully understands it, but she knows that he's this thing she can't have, and this super thing, and he is just like the city. He's taken over the disaster and gone on somehow. And then he says, and your name is Nevers in France. And that means she's taken on this role of the dead city, of stuck in the past, in the gray, and but that's the only thing she can do. Now, I got 3 minutes. I think I'm ready to say the final thing. Let me see now. So she can be joyful. He can be joyful. Then I say, see page 68 in here. Probably I just read page 68, right? Hold on. What is 68? That's interesting. No, I don't need that. Well, who knows? Maybe I need it in here. Too many page 68s. I don't have time to explain it, and I'm not sure I've ever understood it, but on page 68 of the scenario, he says, in a few years when I'll have forgotten you, and when other such adventures from sheer habit will happen to me, I'll remember you as the symbol of love's forgetfulness. I'll think of this adventure as of the horror of oblivion. That is an amazingly hard to understand speech. But what he's saying is that he'll forget her, but he'll remember her. And how will he remember her? Well, he'll remember her as the knight of resignation who had this the anguish of forgetting, it says in the subtitles. Okay, why I read that was, is that there's a special kind of remembering and forgetting. He manages to forget the object of his love. He doesn't go on like that, but he forgets it and he remembers it by taking it over. And I think he's taking over this whole experience with her as now part of his life and his way of relating to things and to people. So let's see now. Now, so he had a world-destroying disaster. He wasn't a lower nature. He didn't forget it, and he isn't a knight of resignation. So he must be a knight of faith. And yet, and that's why we never hear him talking about his disaster or paying any attention to his disaster. And now we understand what he says at the beginning. And that's where I want to end up. Just let me be sure that it's okay. 77. Yeah, okay. So remember how it begins? And how differently now, it's a brilliant thing. So when he says, you saw nothing in Hiroshima, nothing, and she says, she saw everything, what does it mean? It means she saw all the facts about Hiroshima, but she didn't see that Hiroshima was a city which was a night of faith. That it was something that had gone through a total disaster and gone on to be just as finite and temporal and joyful as before and took up the disaster. Or to put it another way, is you understood nothing, remember, he says. And she says, I always wept over the fate of Hiroshima. And he said, what would you have to cry about? Meaning, oh, by the way, though that's important because he hasn't understood her yet either. He doesn't understand her till she mentions Nevers. So he's giving her the, you're just a tourist. What do you have to cry about? So everybody's saying things which turn out to be wrong. But the main thing that turns out to be right, and now we're on the crucial thing on page 22. She says, like you, I know what it is to forget. No, you don't know what it is to forget, you see? I mean, she thinks the only, you either hang on to this or you forget it, and then your whole life just turns into meaninglessness. He understands this deep kind of forgetting where you stop thinking about the other person and dwelling on them, and you dwell in them. So she says, like you, I have a memory, I know what it is. He says, no, you don't have a memory. That's the deep kind of memory. You can't internalize it. And finally, yeah, I think I can stop with that, and I should, because time is up. Okay, so now we see where that's it for that.